Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touch-tone telephone. And as a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, Mary, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop update on the treatment of metastatic renal cell cancer. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration that we have reached so many of you. We have on the call today over 529 participants, and you come from all over the United States. You come from large cities, and you come from small cities, you come from suburban areas, as well as rural and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from Africa, Canada, Egypt, India, Saudi Arabia, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world, and it really is a credit to each of you that you have chosen to spend the next hour with us to learn more about metastatic renal cell cancer. Now, I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there's an outline that our speakers have prepared, and there also is information about all the different collaborating organizations. In addition, there's an evaluation form, and I would ask you to take a moment and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us the topics you'd like us to offer going forward? Indeed, today's topic was one that many of you had asked us to do a workshop on, and so here we are today. So we very much depend upon your feedback. You're our best source of telling us the topics you want us to offer. So please take a moment, tell us what you want, and we'll very much try to offer those programs. Now, today's program was made possible by an educational grant from Genentech Bio-Oncology, and I really want to thank them for their support of our program today. We have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to start by introducing our very first speaker, Dr. David McDermott. And Dr. McDermott is Clinical Director, Biologic Therapy Program, Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. He's Assistant Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School. And Dr. McDermott is going to provide an overview of metastatic renal cell cancer. He's going to talk about the standard of care and new treatment approaches and the role of targeted therapies. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. McDermott.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's certainly a pleasure and an honor to speak to so many patients who are dealing with this difficult condition of kidney cancer. I think we certainly appreciate the opportunity that Cancer Care gives us to speak to so many of you. I think we believe in general that the more educated and involved a patient is, the better their outcome, and we certainly hope that this session provides some information and some guidance and hopefully some hope for all of you as you go forward. I've been asked to talk a little bit about sort of an overview of metastatic kidney cancer, which I'll try to do briefly. I think if you had to pick an area of oncology, of cancer treatment that's experienced the most progress in the last 5 years, with all areas included, I think that area that's seen the most progress probably has been the area of kidney cancer research. If we had this conference 5 years ago, at that time there would be only one FDA-approved drug for the treatment of advanced kidney cancer. That was high-dose interleukin-2, a treatment that, while we specialize in giving it here in Boston, is a very toxic treatment with a very limited benefit. And it was not available to most patients with advanced kidney cancer. Now, sort of move forward 5 years, we have 6 new FDA-approved drugs in our sort of armamentarium for treating patients with advanced kidney cancer. Many of them have been shown to improve survival, which is obviously our most important goal, probably also reducing disease-related symptoms and hopefully improving quality of life for the patients who receive them. And we have, and Dr. Jonasz will talk more about this, we have several drugs likely on the way that we hope are even better than the ones we have, because while we're making progress, we certainly have a lot of work to do. When you think of kidney cancer and it's, you know, how common it is, it's probably 7th or 8th on the list of most common cancers in the United States. It probably affects a little over 50,000 people a year. So while it might seem like you may not know many people like you, there are quite a few people like you out there who are dealing with this disease. I think the things that we've learned over the last few years, we've learned importantly that not all kidney cancer is the same. Kidney cancer is sort of an umbrella diagnosis, but there are probably 5 or 6 different types of cancer that emerge from the kidney. We're learning a lot about what drives these tumors forward, and we're actually getting better at personalizing our approaches to individual patients with certain types of kidney cancer. So, for example, there are certain drugs that might work for the most common type of kidney cancer, which is clear cell kidney cancer, that might have less effect on some of the less common types. And by understanding these differences, we can focus treatment and hopefully improve outcomes. Not only are we learning that not all kidney cancer is the same, we're also learning that not all patients with kidney cancer are the same. There are patients who need immediate therapy because they have a lot of symptoms at the time of their diagnosis. There are others that do not have as many symptoms or do not maybe have any symptoms. Some of those people probably do not need immediate treatment. Some of those people could do just as well with a period of observation before beginning treatment, or more might want to take that time to consider the latest treatments that are being developed through clinical trials. So not every patient with kidney cancer is the same, and not every patient should be treated the same. I think in the last 5 years, you know, if we were to sort of go back to 2005, there are things that were used besides high-dose interleukin-2, included low doses of interferon, which is a therapy that works through the immune system like interleukin-2, and chemotherapy, and sometimes hormonal therapy. Those treatments were generally either had limited activity or were essentially inactive. But through understanding what drives the disease forward, what actually spurs it on, what has made it so traditionally tough to kill with standard treatments like chemotherapy and radiation, we're making progress. And one of these basic understandings that's developed over the last 5 or 10 years is that there are certain genetic changes that occur within the tumors of people with kidney cancer that allow these tumors to grow and to spread. One of these genetic changes is a mutation called a von Hippel-Lindau gene mutation. And when this occurs in a kidney tumor, without getting into too much details, it allows the tumor to develop a very strong blood supply, which is obviously good for the tumor's health, meaning with a blood supply, a tumor can grow to a large size, it can spread more easily, but it's obviously not good from a patient's point of view because it makes tumors, and one of the reasons why tumors of the kidney are more resistant to things like radiation and chemotherapy. But by understanding what drives kidney cancer, we've been able to target some new treatments and use them in some ways to make kidney cancer more vulnerable. So if you think of kidney cancer as a tumor with a lot of blood supply, maybe drugs that actually work targeting that blood supply to try to cut it off will be effective. And it turns out that these drugs, the medical term for these drugs are what's called angiogenesis inhibitors. Angiogenesis stands for essentially new blood vessels. So these drugs actually block the development of new blood vessels. And because they do, and because kidney tumors have so many blood vessels, these drugs are more effective in kidney cancer than they are in almost any other form of cancer as single drugs. So you're seeing you could call it almost an explosion of new drugs that all work in a very similar way by targeting the way these tumors make blood vessels, that they're less targeting the cancer itself than the blood supply. And what they've shown us, and there are several examples of them, for example, things like sunitinib and sorafenib and now pazopanib and bevacizumab, all of these drugs have shown us the ability to shrink renal tumors in the majority of patients who receive them. And by shrinking them and preventing their spread, they've led to meaningful increases in survival, meaning patients are now living a lot longer than they were just 5 years ago with this condition. And while they present challenges, which we certainly can talk about as far as managing the side effects, which is something that Dr. Yonash will focus on more, they present challenges because they often have sometimes very annoying side effects. They can generally be offered to a broader population of people. More patients can receive them than prior older treatments. They're helping people live longer and hopefully helping them live better. So now, you know, moving forward to 2010, we now have six new drugs, so seven drugs total for the treatment of kidney cancer, and with more on the way, meaning there are several drugs that you may have heard about, and Dr. Yonash will talk probably about some of these new drugs that are in late-stage clinical trials that will likely become FDA-approved drugs in the next year or two, and hopefully offering even more help and more hope to patients dealing with this condition. I think the so in general, what we see with these treatments is for the most part, most patients who receive them achieve some tumor shrinkage, probably as high as maybe 70 or 80% of patients receiving these drugs achieve some benefit. But one of the questions for the field is, what do you do when these drugs stop working? Because unfortunately, for most patients, in far too short a time from their point of view, an individual treatment will stop working. And then the question is, what do you do at that point? Do you move to a different treatment? Do you consider clinical trials? Do you talk about combination treatments, which means two drugs instead of one? And the field of research is sort of going in all of those directions at the same time, meaning we're looking at new agents, as I mentioned, which are hopefully better than the old. We're also looking at combinations of new drugs, which has been shown to be effective in other cancers, meaning, for example, breast cancer and colon cancer are often treated with two or three drugs at the same time, and those have shown improvements in outcome for people dealing with those conditions. We're hoping the same will be true in kidney cancer, but that remains to be shown. But I think the one thing that can be said is when you put these drugs together, no matter which one you start with, if you receive more than one, when you add all the benefits up, the in sequence, we're seeing a meaningful improvement in patient survival and patient outcome, which is very important to us. I think that one example, just from my personal practice, of how that improvement is sort of manifesting itself is when you look at the number of new patients that are sent to our institution for evaluation, that number over the last 5 years has gone down, in large part because patients can receive the treatments now close to home, which is great. But the number of patients in our clinics has actually gone up slightly over that time, even though we're seeing less new patients. And the reason that is because patients are living longer, which is great. And we're certainly seeing that, that improvement. But we still have several questions remain. We obviously need to make a lot more progress. You know, we need to move to drugs that are offering durable remission, treatments that will shrink the cancer and keep it shrunk for a period of time, not looking for benefits that last years more than months. And hopefully with research, we'll start seeing those kind of benefits, which we're not seeing now. Another thing we're also developing is ways of predicting who will benefit from which treatment. So we're working hard on blood tests, for example, or tests of patients' tumors that will predict which patient should get treatment A versus treatment B, and what to do when treatment A stops working. We're also getting an increased understanding of how to treat the less common kidney cancers, these what are called, that are sort of lumped into the group of non-clear cell kidney cancer. There are certain genetic mutations that probably drive these tumors as well, and there are drugs that are now being developed that may offer help for those patients. And we need to push that development forward. And one of the ways I think we can push the development of these new agents forward is by getting more involved, getting a better, more cohesive group of patients who will put pressure on folks to develop these drugs, both pharmaceutical companies and the government. We need – one of the things we lack in the field of kidney cancer is an incredibly mobilized patient support group. We need more patients involved. We need more we need more encouragement to funding research so we can push these treatments closer to final development. I think the other thing we're also looking at too is we now have these treatments which have been shown to improve survival for patients with advanced cancer. The question now is, one of the other questions we have is, can these treatments be used earlier in the disease process to prevent recurrence? And this is something that Dr. Yonash will probably also speak about as well, this question of adjuvant treatment or preventative treatment, ways of following surgery giving drugs and hoping that this will prevent the recurrence following a surgery. And several of these new drugs are now in treatments, now in clinical trials in that setting, and we hope they will prevent recurrence, although that that certainly remains to be seen. So I think in general we're making progress. We have treatments that improve survival. They do have side effects, some of which can be quite annoying, but for most patients they're not dangerous. They need to be managed. I think from a toxicity point of view, patients need to be well educated about how to manage these side effects, because oftentimes they run into trouble, and they run into trouble quickly, and they might be managed more smoothly if they were to hold treatment and to wait for the symptoms to resolve. So that's something we need a lot more education around for patients. But we need to explore these questions about, when do we start treatment? You know, do two treatments work better than one? You know, what do we do when treatment fails? But all of those things are being actively explored. And if you're in a situation where you're looking for options, there are clinical trials out there that explore most of these areas. And that one good place to go is the clinicaltrials.gov website, where most of the trials that I've alluded to are mentioned. So hopefully that was a helpful overview, and hopefully that sort of gives you a sense of where we're at right now, and I'd be glad to take questions later.
Well, really just an outstanding, excellent presentation, Dr. McDermott, and very informative as well, and with lots of really just wonderful information. I know there'll be lots of questions for you during the Q&A, and you also have given people information about where to get more information about clinical trials at the National Cancer Institute website, www.cancer.gov, which is a great site to go to for further information. Now, I would like to introduce our next speaker, Dr. Eric Jonasz, who is Associate Professor of Medicine, Department of Genitourinary Medical Oncology, Director of VHL Clinical Center, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Dr. Jonasz is going to cover clinical trials, how research contributes to treatment options, managing side effects and pain, and communicating with your healthcare team. It's now my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Jonasz.
Thank you, Carolyn. And thank you to the audience for participating today, and I look forward to the question and answer session. So I'm going to cover three main topics over the next few minutes. The first is, how does research contribute to treatment options in kidney cancer? The second is going to be managing side effects and pain with both the cancer and the treatments. And also the third, communication with your healthcare team. So on to the first topic. How does research contribute to treatment options? The bottom line is that the advances that we have seen in kidney cancer over the past 10 years really have been because of patients like you who have taken the time to participate in clinical trials to test novel drugs for the treatment of patients with kidney cancer. And there are three different types of trials that usually are offered, and I'll summarize those. Phase 1 trials. Test the maximally tolerated dose of a drug, and oftentimes are not specific to a particular disease, although as a phase 1 trial evolves, we may start getting hints as to whether or not a particular drug is useful. Phase 2 trials determine whether a particular drug is helpful in a specific subset of patients, and that would mean, for example, it would be a trial looking at a new drug for patients with kidney cancer to see whether or not that drug is demonstrating a signal with regards to response, prolongation of response, and perhaps signs of prolongation of survival. And then ultimately, the phase 3 trials are asking the question whether the drug being investigated is as good as or better than existing standard treatments. And for the approved drugs that have come online in the last 5 years, each one of them has gone through these different phases. So there are several ways that research results can provide new discoveries for patients with kidney cancers, and let's sort of describe some strategies that the scientists use. The first, and sorafenib or Nexavar is an example of this, is what I would call a lucky break strategy. basically you have a drug that's in a phase 1 or a phase 2 trial where you don't really know yet whether the drug is specific for a particular disease. And patients are being enrolled in these trials, and then there's this the investigators notice that the kidney cancer patients are starting to benefit preferentially. And then these trials sometimes are designed where you can start enriching for a specific subgroup of patients. And that's exactly what happened with Nexavar. And ultimately, Nexavar went on to do in a phase 3 trial and was approved specifically for kidney cancer, although nobody expected that the drug would be beneficial for patients with kidney cancer initially. So that does give hope to individuals who are in phase 1 or more general phase 2 trials, that it's possible that these drugs may have some benefit in that particular subset. And this, actually, the success with sorafenib or Nexavar did then spur on further research and the approval of three of the blood vessel-starving drugs through clinical trials. The second strategy really is more of a scientific one, where you have what I would call a bedside-to-bench-to-bedside strategy. And here what happens is you have doctors who are treating patients perhaps with particular therapies and make observations of whether or not patients are benefiting or not benefiting from a particular therapy. And then they go back into the lab and they look at tumor tissue and perform experiments and generate theories about which drugs would be helpful. And then they go back and generate clinical trials to see which new drug may actually address this particular resistance pathway. And this is, I think, the more exciting way to develop drugs, and is one that is now just starting to gain traction in the kidney cancer world. Example of a drug that blocks a particular protein, AKT, this can be opened through a number of different centers. Through the next year, the drug's called MK2206, and that's sort of essentially testing whether or not this type of research will provide more insight. There are a number of other drugs that are in clinical trials that are in mid to late phase. There's a drug called tivozanib, which is being tested, which is another blood vessel starving drug, and also there's a drug called davitinib, which is also going to be moving forward in clinical trials. And I just want to reiterate what's important in all of these strategies is that patients need to be involved in these trials, and it's that participation that moves our knowledge forward. It may help other patients ultimately, and it may help the person who's participating in the trial. I'm going to move on now to managing side effects and managing pain. Clearly, none of the medications that we have for kidney cancer are without problems. And the key thing to managing the side effects really is, first of all, to become educated on the potential side effects of the drugs and the management of that. The second important thing as a patient is making sure that you're very careful in documenting the side effects you experience, so that when you do speak with your doctor, you'll be able to communicate well and describe what's going on, and that will help the team, the nurses, the doctors, and the whole treatment team tailor your therapies. And then the third thing, of course, as I've alluded to, is communication, which I'll get to at the end. It is critically important throughout the whole process. So how do you become educated? First of all, when you're in the office and you're with the treatment team, don't be afraid to ask questions about side effects when you talk about the drugs in the first place. Some patients will go online and look up the drugs and their side effects ahead of time, and that way they'll be prepared with questions when these things are covered in the office. If you do that, you can have a good dialogue with your treating team, and the information in the doctor's office will be less overwhelming, and you'll then be able to ask questions about some of the things you've heard, and it won't be the first time. The other thing that's very helpful is to bring a family member to your office visit. Two heads or three heads are almost always better than one, and that way one person can take notes while the other asks questions, and you can talk about what you heard. The next thing is to document the side effects when you're on the medicine. It's very important that your treatment team know what the frequency, severity, time course of the side effects is. And that way, the team can help adjust your medications in the way to maximize the benefit from the treatment and minimize the downsides. And sort of a rule of thumb, when you're on an oral medication like sunitinib or pazopanib or sorafenib, is if you're feeling lousy, stop the drug and ask questions second. Your treatment of these drugs is not like a string of pearls. It's not that if you miss one dose, it's going to break the thread of treatment and have the benefits fall apart. It's more important that you're healthy and strong, and in the end, you're actually going to be able to take more medication and derive more benefit. Similar principles apply to managing pain as well, but there are a few key differences. Once again, I think education on the benefits and side effects of pain medications is really important, and you need to speak to your treating team about that. But different from the treatment therapies that I was talking about before, pain control is critical from the very beginning. If you don't stamp down the pain, the amount of medicine you need is actually greater than if you properly control it from the outset. So with pain medications, it's important to really get the pain under control, not miss doses, and that way your pain control will be far better, and you won't be playing catch-up. And additionally, there's not only one pain management drug. There's a number of different narcotic-based drugs, and everyone's different. Everyone's metabolism's a little bit different. Some work better for some people and some for others. And there are some non-narcotic drugs like nerve medications, and also anti-inflammatory drugs. So I just wanted to conclude with the comment on communication of the healthcare team. I think we've alluded to that already several times. And the key thing to remember is that communication is a two-way street. Caregivers, patients, and the treatment team have obligations here. So when you have your first visit with the treatment team, make sure you obtain the contact numbers for the key players, including the nurse practitioner, and the doctor's office. Ask how the communication system works. Who are the go-to people, and how do they prefer being communicated with? Some offices insist that you show up. Others will prefer phone calls, and others will even take emails, and find out how it works. The other thing is sometimes being a little patient is also important. You know, in the doctor's office, things are very busy, so if you leave a message in the morning, the likelihood is high that you'll probably get a response through the course of the day. And if you're not getting that type of response, I think it's really important that you let the doctor know that you're having trouble getting through, because we obviously can't fix a problem if we're not aware of it. So I just wanted to conclude by saying that treatment of cancer, both the clinical trials, the management of side effects, is really a partnership between the patients, the caregivers, and the treatment team. And by actively working on this relationship, you're really going to derive maximum benefit. So thank you very much, and I look forward to feedback.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Dr. Yonis. It's really really excellent presentation and really very sensitive to the issues of communication and managing side effects, just really excellent. Thank you. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Our next speaker is Joan Galvin. She is a clinical dietitian, and she's with the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And she's going to really talk to you about nutritional concerns and tips. We know that's an area of concern to many of you. Joan?
Well, thank you so much, and good morning, I guess good afternoon, everyone. And thank you so much for allowing me to discuss the nutrition concerns and tips for individuals with renal cell cancer. And like Carolyn said, my name is Joan, and I'm here at MD Anderson Cancer Center. Today, we're going to discuss ways to minimize some of the side effects of treatment through nutrition, because good nutrition is such an important part of your cancer treatment. This will include suggestions on how to manage loss of appetite, ways to help maintain your weight, and tips for changes of taste. Some of the tips for loss of appetite would be, you want to try to eat 6 to 8 smaller, more frequent meals or snacks throughout the day. You want to definitely try to limit greasy, fried, or high-fat foods, which may be difficult to digest. Another thing may be to take advantages of the times you're hungriest. So if you're hungrier in the morning, eat a little bit more then. You also want to make your meals nice and enjoyable and in a pleasant atmosphere. You want to keep snacks available to you, whether you're at home or out doing errands. And you may want to even try some of the nutritional supplements, milkshakes, or smoothies. Some snack ideas for you may include peanut butter with crackers or toast, maybe graham crackers with milk, cheese and crackers, instant breakfast, a bagel with cream cheese, dried fruit and nuts, half of a sandwich with fruit or juice, and nutritional supplements like Ensure, Boost, Carnation, Instant Breakfast. Any of those will do. Some ways to maintain your body weight, especially when you're not eating well, would be what we call power packing your foods. So that would be things that are very calorie dense, foods like avocados, cheese, unsalted nuts, nut butters, dried fruit, fresh fruit, oil, granola, or honey. So for an example would be, instead of just having plain toast, you may want to add some peanut butter or honey or cheese to help add those calories to there. Also, you may want to do some small, more frequent meals and keep snacks around the house. Some of the snacks may need to be convenience foods. So that would include granola bars, fruit or fruit juices, trail mix, peanut butter with crackers, cheese with crackers, Jell-O, some low-sodium soup, dried cereals, plain yogurt, just to name a few things. You may want to use caution with some of these foods because if you start having problems with your kidney function, you may need to limit some of the foods that are high in protein or potassium. So you definitely want to ask your dietitian or healthcare professionals to set up a meal that is right for you. Lastly, some people have changes of taste during their treatments. You may want to try rinsing out your mouth with a baking soda solution before eating to help clean out your mouth of any unpleasant tastes. That would be 1/4 teaspoon of baking soda and 4 ounces of water. Also, we definitely want you to drink adequate fluids. So you can flavor your water, for instance, with mint, lemon, cucumber, or fruit. But you do want to ask your healthcare team what the appropriate amount of liquids is right for you because it varies from person to person. You want to try chewing sugar-free gum, peppermints, or lemon drops. And some people have tastes that are kind of metallic in their mouth. So when this happens, you may want to try to use plastic utensils or avoid canned foods. Also, if foods are tasting too sweet, you may want to increase the salty or tart flavor to foods. So you may want to use some lemon or citrus or vinegar. And then if foods are tasting too salty or bitter, you want to increase the sweet flavor of things. So you may want to add honey or maple syrup or agave nectar to some of your foods. Well, thank you so much, everyone, for inviting me today. And I hope this was helpful to some of you. And I hope you have a great day. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much, Joan. Just some wonderful tips for everybody, just really excellent tips. And I know there'll be questions for you because this is really such an important issue for everybody on the call and really contributes to everyone's quality of life. So thank you so much. And our next speaker is Keith Lyons. Keith is an oncology social worker, and he's program coordinator for cancer care. And he's really going to talk about the services that you can access for free from cancer care. I'm now going to turn the program over to Keith.
Thank you, Carolyn. I would like our audience to know that Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer Care programs, and that includes counseling, support groups, education, some limited financial assistance, and practical help, are provided by oncology social workers and are completely free of charge. You can learn more about Cancer Care and access our services by visiting our website at www.cancercare.org. Now, I would like to identify some of the many psychosocial issues involved with a metastatic renal cell cancer diagnosis. Adjusting to and accepting the diagnosis is the first issue that confronts a person. Being diagnosed with metastatic renal cell cancer can turn your world upside down. Before you have a chance to absorb the diagnosis, you're usually confronted with having to make treatment decisions within a very short period of time, often without knowing what questions to ask and where to get that information. And metastatic renal cell cancer and its treatments may impact a person's bodily functions, habits, and care, depending on the treatment regimen. The diagnosis may also impact body image, sexuality, self-esteem, energy level, and how a person views the future. normal feelings of sadness, anger, fear, and frustration may also arise as a result. We know that cancer does not just affect the individual receiving the diagnosis. It affects the entire family and social network of that individual. So if you are a caregiver, family member, or friend, you might be searching for the right way to communicate, walking a fine line of being respectful of your loved one's privacy and wanting, even needing, to address important sensitive issues. So how can patients, caregivers, and family members address these issues? Well, an oncology social worker can provide assistance by breaking the concerns down into manageable segments and addressing each one individually. People react differently to the diagnosis and treatment. Therefore, no single strategy works for everyone, and suggestions and interventions need to be tailored to the individual. Support groups may help. Support groups can lessen the sense of isolation and aloneness that accompanies the diagnosis. Support groups focus on coping with, adaptation to, and living with cancer. Sometimes anxiety stemming from uncertainty often creates more havoc than the disease itself. Participating in a support group may help anticipate what might come next and how to handle that situation if it does. Presently, Cancer Care offers patient phone support groups and online groups and caregiver phone support groups and online groups. Now, you may feel that you are not prepared to face these challenges alone. No one should face a metastatic renal cell cancer diagnosis alone. Let us help you navigate these difficult issues. Connect with a Cancer Care Oncology social worker who will work with you on a plan to address your needs. A plan may include information and referrals, educational materials, coaching, counseling, a support group, limited financial assistance, a sounding board for ideas and options, all offered in a simple, understandable, straightforward manner. Now, some patients have said that they have not sought psychosocial support because they were not aware of support services or because they didn't think they needed them. It's been my intention today that by highlighting some of the psychosocial issues of a metastatic renal cell cancer diagnosis, our listeners will be able to identify these issues and know that support does exist and how to access that support. So contact Cancer Care, even if it is to learn that what you are doing and experiencing is appropriate. It's always good to learn you're on the right track. Thank you, Carolyn.
Well, thank you so much, Keith. It's really terrific. And in terms of your description of all the services that people can access and take advantage of for free from Cancer Care. And now we have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask Mary to bring all of our speakers on board and then to explain to everybody how to queue up for questions. And we are going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. If we do not get to your question, please feel that you can contact Cancer Care after the call at 1-800-813-HOPE, and our staff will be here to answer your questions. Mary, can you explain how to queue up for questions?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Our first question comes from LaDonna C.
Hi. I was just asking, you had stated earlier that there were 5 to 6 types of kidney cancer. And I noted the clear cell and non-clear cell, but could you tell me the other names of kidney cancers?
That's a great question. Thank you. Dr. McDermott, would you go over that again, please?
Sure. I think the majority of people dealing with advanced kidney cancer have clear cell kidney cancer. That's about 70 or 80% of folks. Non-clear cell cancer is broken down into several different subgroups, which are much smaller. The most common of those groups is what's called papillary kidney cancer, and there are 2 different types of papillary kidney cancer. There are also types that are even less common, like chromophobe kidney cancer and oncocytoma. There are different types of tumors that can arise from the near the kidney, like a collecting duct tumor, for example, that are often grouped in with kidney cancer. But are treated differently. I think there's less known about the individual treatments for this group of what's called non-clear cell cancer. But there is some information that comes from clinical trials, and there's some drugs that may be applicable to individual patients. I think that being said, I think if you have one of these, you know, less common types, it's even more incentive because there's less standard treatments, more incentive to ask your oncologist, you know, are there clinical trials for me? You know, could I, you know, get a second opinion with someone who sees a lot of kidney cancer so you can make sure that you're, you know, you're getting the, you know, the latest view on what's going on with these less common conditions.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Mark M.
Hi, thank you. The protocol for my mother has been across the board from all oncologists has been gemcitabine, and I'd like to have some recommendations or advice from, you know, the oncologist there on that particular drug and maybe supplemented with maybe another drug, and she's 80 years of age, and what your recommendations may be.
And would you just indicate her type of cancer just so we have a little sense of the...
She has metastasized. Well, she had her kidney removed because of the cancer, but it's TCC.
Mm-hmm. Okay, excellent. Okay, thank you for that question, Mark. I'm going to actually ask Dr. McDermott to address your question, but I'm going to ask him to address it in a general way. And we hope that you can then take the information that he provides back to your treating healthcare team. And that's true for everyone on the call. And so you have a little bit more information in terms of just the basic general question you've asked. Dr. McDermott, could you address that general question?
Sure. So the condition TCC, that it stands for transitional cell carcinoma, that's also not, you know, one of the standard flavors of kidney cancer. That type of tumor is often more similar to tumors that arise from the bladder and the ureter. So these type of cancers are have not been included for the most part in the trials that we've talked about, Dr. Yonesh and I, that have led to the developments of these new treatments. These tumors are very distinct from the most common forms of kidney cancer and are probably less responsive to these newer therapies based on what drives these tumors. They are, however, more typically responsive than regular kidney cancer is to chemotherapy. So and the drug that was mentioned is a pretty standard chemotherapy drug called gemcitabine, which is often used for tumors that arise in the bladder. So it's not surprising that an oncologist looking to apply, you know, knowledge from one area might be applying chemotherapy to a transitional cell tumor as a way of, you know, treating it, you know, based on what the tumor it's most like, as opposed to a kidney cancer, which it actually is very different from, and probably wouldn't benefit from a lot of these treatments that have been mentioned. You know, it's hard to comment too much more in general without knowing the specific case, but it sounds like, you know, that's a fairly standard approach to, you know, this type of cancer.
So, Mark, we hope that was helpful to you and to others on the call, and you'll take this information back to your treating healthcare team so they can tailor it specifically to your mom and to what would be most helpful to her. So thank you for your question, and thank you for the answer, Dr. McDermott. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Lena C. Lena, if your line is on mute, will you please unmute?
Oh, is it Lena Coleman?
Yes. Hi. Your question?
Yeah. Is this disease comes most about people with diabetics? Because see, I have type 2 diabetes.
And your question in terms of, do you also have kidney cancer?
No, I don't have that, but see, I'm a diabetic, and my doctor told me to learn most as I can about about diabetes and stuff. And, you know, I have a friend, he took and died. He had metastatic breast cancer. Metastatic kidney cancer. Now, that's why I was interested in the teleconference to learn more about it. And that's my question. I said, you know, he told me he caught the disease because he drank a lot of alcohol. That's why he got something wrong with his kidney and stuff.
Now, that's your question?
Yeah. My question how you catch the disease, that's my question.
That's an excellent question, actually, that you're asking. I think it's probably a question that people always ask, like, how did this happen to me? How did I get this type of cancer? I'm going to ask Dr. Yonesh if he would address that question in a general way, in terms of just the of course, you hear this question all the time, and what can we say to people in terms of how do these cancers occur? And that's true for many cancers. Dr. Yonesh, would you just address it in a general way?
Yes, an excellent question, and frequently patients will come in and will ask, why me, and what, and ask, is there something I did that made this happen? And I think for the large part, it really is not something that we do, although there are a few things in our lifestyles and behaviors that might influence the development of kidney cancer. So just to recap, there are close to 50,000 cases of this disease per year, and one of the things that people ask is whether or not there's a genetic component. Is there something that runs in families? And that may be true in a very small percentage of cases. So this is not frequently a hereditary cancer. But if you do have a family member who has kidney cancer, you'll have a slightly increased risk of having it. But it is actually not enough for us to really warrant or recommend regular screening. In terms of the things that are most closely associated with the development of kidney cancer, men get this more often than women for reasons that we don't know. It's also something that occurs more frequently as you grow older, with an average age somewhere around 60 years of age. So in terms of environmental or modifiable things that may be associated with the development of kidney cancer, it's fairly clear that smoking, a history of smoking, has been linked to the development of kidney cancer. Overweight being an obesity is linked as well, as is the development or the history of high blood pressure. So to specifically address the question of whether diabetes is associated with the development of kidney cancer, the answer is we don't have any information that it in of itself is, but diabetes is sometimes associated with high blood pressure and obesity, so maybe indirectly there might be some sort of an association, but that's not clearly been defined. I think really for the large majority of people, this is one of these things that we just don't know why people have developed this cancer, and we're obviously trying to better understand why it happens.
Thank you so much. That's a really wonderful answer, and I want to thank you very much for the question as well. We have a question that came in online. I just want to ask this question of our speakers. What happens if a person has really no symptoms? How do they decide about starting a therapy and treatment? Dr. McDermott, could you address that question?
Sure. I think this is a challenging question in the sense that when diagnosed with advanced cancer, many people react normally, that they want something done and they want it done quickly, which is, to be expected. I think there is always, however, a trade-off between the side effects of treatment, as they affect quality of life, and drugs that might help one live longer. I think there is an increasing understanding that not every person who has advanced kidney cancer needs immediate treatment. So, for example, if they have a very small amount of advanced cancer and no symptoms, a period of observation where they're going to see their doctor, having exams, blood work, CAT scans, is a way of maintaining a good quality of life and saving that treatment for when it's absolutely necessary, when there's clear signs of growth or spread of the condition. There's clear evidence that these treatments work well, but they're not producing remissions of cancer. They're stopping the growth, they're slowing the spread. So the longer we can wait to start these treatments, probably the longer people will live. And probably in that time when they're off treatment, the quality of life will remain good. Now, it takes a special patient to sort of hear that message and say, that's okay with me. You've got to be okay with watching and waiting. And sometimes that's not okay for every person. Some people feel the need to do something and do it right away. But I would encourage folks without symptoms to consider either holding off on treatment or having breaks in their treatment as a way of maintaining a good quality of life. And also in that time when they don't have symptoms from their condition, they could also take the time to consider clinical trials, because it's only through that process where we will be able to answer some of these important questions going forward.
Thank you. And there is another question just about the sequencing of treatment and how treatment is offered. And Dr. Jonasz, could you address that?
A very, very good question, Carolyn. With the development or the approval now of a total of seven drugs for kidney cancer, one of the questions patients frequently ask is, well, you know, which one first and how do we actually use these drugs? And there are a couple of principles. One that I want to touch on what Dr. McDermott pointed out, it's critically important that we make sure that patients remain healthy and remain well while they're receiving treatment. If we make people sick with our therapies, we may ultimately hamper their ability to receive more treatment, and then they're not going to have the drugs work, and they're going to do poorly. So making sure that we don't overdose, if you will, and cause a lot of problems with these drugs is key. So of the seven drugs, one of them, the high-dose interleukin-2 therapy, was the one that was approved in 1992, is one that has been associated in a small percentage of individuals with some complete disappearance of the disease. And that drug also carries with it a fair number of side effects. Now, one of the questions was, in people who received some of these newer drugs, could you then go on to receive high-dose interleukin-2 afterwards? Data actually from Dr. McDermott's group and his colleagues suggest that that's probably a risky thing. There's a higher incidence of side effects if you start with one of the blood vessel starving or anti-angiogenic drugs and follow that with high-dose interleukin-2 or Proleukin. So from a sequencing perspective, in terms of if you're asking your doctor, is there one drug that I have to get first if I'm going to take it, it would probably be high-dose IL-2. Now, that's not to say that high-dose IL-2 is for everyone, and I have to say that the majority of our patients choose not to be on that agent, and it's not. I'm not saying that it should be given first. With regards to the other drugs, we really have two major classes of agents. We have the blood vessel starving or anti-angiogenic agents, and then we have the mTOR inhibitors, which are everolimus and temsirolimus. We have good evidence and good data that a drug like sunitinib, bevacizumab, pazopanib works very well in the frontline setting and does improve the time of progression of the cancer. In terms of what happens when you actually progress on one of these drugs, we have good data, meaning a phase 3 study, which was done with a fairly large number of patients, that everolimus does provide a benefit if you've progressed on one of the other agents. And one of the things that's really important, though, is that everyone's different. So I think the major principle, with the exception of high-dose IL-2, is that the sequence is probably not as important as making sure that you stay well enough to be able to try other drugs, because sometimes it takes two or three different drugs until you actually find something that really does work for your cancer. And that comes back to the concept of communication, making sure that you have a good relationship with your treatment team that keeps you well and makes sure that we do know exactly how the drug is affecting you.
Well, thank you very much. That's an excellent answer, and I really appreciate that, and I'm sure all of our attendees do as well. This has been actually an exceptional call, I have to say. Our speakers have been absolutely outstanding. All of you as participants asked such really great questions. And you also, those of you who have been listening as well, it's just been an amazing call. I want to thank you all for participating today. I want to remind you that this is a one-hour program and that in planning a program like this, we recognize that you have many needs that go far beyond the scope of a one-hour program. With that in mind, I do want to remind all of you that although the program itself, this workshop, is going to end soon, your ability to access help and services from cancer care, that's endless, and that continues as long as you need that help. And that's a very important takeaway message for you all to get. So you have a lot of information that you got today. We want you to take that back to your treating healthcare team. But we also know that there may be many concerns you have. And I think I just want to reiterate, we have a staff of 60 master's level trained oncology social workers. We're here to provide practical and financial help, support help, someone to talk to, counseling, and we have all different types of support groups, both on the telephone and online, and we have lots of these type of workshops to offer, as well as materials. So we pretty much have something for everyone, and please do take advantage of the programs. And they are available both to the person living with renal cell cancer, a person with cancer, to family members, friends, caregivers. So it's really the service available to everybody. I really want no one to leave this call feeling that you're alone. I want you to now feel that you're part of a community of support, and you can take advantage of those services anytime you wish. And I want to thank you so much for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.